We're going to be looking at a little bit of Luke chapter 23. Now, we're going to jump around just a little bit, so don't, you know, think that, oh, well, once he reads this passage, then, you know, I plop it closed or whatever. Keep that open, and because we'll be hitting several verses there in Luke chapter 23. I want us just to go ahead and bow for just a few moments of prayer, and just to kind of still us. I know that with everything with the snow, of having to get out in this and stuff like that, sometimes it just creates an anxiety. And so let's just kind of bow for prayer and just kind of release that anxiety to God, where we can kind of hone in on what he has for us this morning. Lord, we thank you for this time together. We thank you that we can assemble in a place like this that is so nice to be able to worship in. It's comfortable. It's out of the snow. And so, Lord, we just thank you for a place that we can worship. And I know, Lord, for me, it was just anxious this morning as we were trying to figure out how to get here, which car we might take, would we have to shovel our way out? And Lord, I just thank you for the people that were able to get out. I know that there were probably some others that couldn't and wanted to be here. And so, Lord, I just thank you that we can assemble in this place, but most importantly, that we can devote our attention to you on this Easter Sunday morning. I just pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. As Sherry and I were trying to figure out this morning which car to take, mine is in an outdoor parking garage type thing. Hers is inside. It's the way it works around our house. Okay, if you're not married, that's the way it'll work around your house. Okay, you just need to know that, guys. If you hadn't figured that out already, that's the way that it works. And so we were trying to figure out how we were going to get here, and I noticed that the plow had already come through, which is a blessing if you can get to the street. Okay, like getting to the street is usually the obstacle. And so I said, well, honey, let me walk downstairs and let me just see which one's going to be the easiest to get to. And so I open up the door that goes outside of our apartment there at Bridgeview, and I barely get the door open. Okay, so I knew then, all right, unless we want 3 feet of snow to trudge through to get to my car, that's not the option. But then I knew this is going to be the coolest thing ever. We've got to break through this thing like the Dukes of Hazzard. You know what I'm saying? Some of you may have had to do that this morning. You know exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, I really hope that's the fluffy stuff. Because if it's not, you know what happens, right? The whole front of your car messes up, and then you get on top of it, and it goes, you know, and you know what happens then. You're stuck. And so Sherry was just like, let's just plow through it. And I was like, preach it, sister. Let's go. So sure enough, man, right out of Bridgeview Apartments, she goes, and after I was committed, I mean, I've already got a good rate of speed, you know, about 20 miles an hour coming out of the garage, which is a high rate of speed when you're in a garage, and coming out of there. Right as we're about to exit, she goes, shouldn't you look for oncoming traffic? Which is an issue, because if you know where we live on Bridgeview, there is St. Clair Avenue that goes right down to the river. So if someone's coming down the hill, guess what? They're committed as well, all right, because they're not stopping. And I was like, it's too late, I'm committed. And I thought, man, we could really crash here. But we busted through the snow going everywhere. I make the left turn so that we're sliding out on the snow, and bang, we hit the street, and whoo, you know, we're going out. I'm like, yes. Now, that's the way to go to church on a Sunday morning, you know. You really get some adrenaline flowing, you know, early in the morning. So some of you have probably got some good stories. I do want to remind you, we do have free parking right over here at the 515 Euclid Garage. If you don't know that, you came this morning, you're worried about going back out and your car having snow all along the side of it because the plow finally came by the street. We do have parking over there. It's free, validated, either here probably in a couple weeks once we get our own stamp, over there for at least the next week or so. So if you parked over there, someone didn't stamp your ticket, make sure that happens before you leave out. You don't have to pay anything to park over there. And it's just right across the street, makes it real easy. Luke chapter 23 is where we're going to be. We're in the middle of the series about love God. Everyone always asks me, what is Gateway Church about? We've boiled it down to basically what we want to get across is three things. Number one is love God. Okay. Number two is live in community. And number three is serve the city. All right. We're on that first part, love God. And then we're going to switch to, in a couple of weeks, to what does it mean to live in community? What does that mean? What is that all about? And I'll do several messages on living community, and then the final part of that, serving the city, I'll do several messages. If you happen to miss one, this is not permission for you to sit at home in your PJs and not come, but if you happen to miss one, we are putting those on our website, so you can just log on to Gateway Cleveland. I think it's on the resources page. You'll find all of my messages for the next, I think it's through May the 20th, something like that. You can go on there and you'll see the little emblem and you can click on whatever last week's was. It usually takes us a day or two to get those up. So if you missed our launch Sunday, you can go back and listen to that and hear that message. But maybe that'll help you. I know sometimes you're out of town, work-related, things like that. This will help you to stay connected with us, okay? You're not going to get the same power of the message unless you're here, okay? That's my sell to have you come. Luke chapter 23, let's look at a few verses here, specifically verses 1 through 9. And we're talking about this morning the question of who is he? Love God, who is he? You know, there's a lot of questions about who is God, who is he really? And so let's look at these verses, verses 1 through 9. Then the entire council took Jesus over to Pilate, the Roman governor. They began at once to state their case. This man has been leading our people to ruin by telling them not to pay their taxes to the Roman government and by claiming he is the Messiah, a king. So Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus replied, "Yes, it is as you say." Pilate turned to the leading priest and to the crowd and said, "I find nothing wrong with this man." Then they became desperate. "But he is causing riots everywhere he goes, all over Judea, from Galilee to Jerusalem." "Oh, he is a Galilean?" Pilate asked. When they answered that he was, Pilate sent him to Herod Antipas, because Galilee was under Herod's jurisdiction, and Herod happened to be in Jerusalem at the time. Herod was delighted at the opportunity to see Jesus because he had heard about him and had been hoping for a long time to see him perform a miracle. He asked Jesus question after question, but Jesus refused to answer. Now, I want us just to kind of walk through this. This is in our main passage this morning, but it kind of sets up the whole crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. And I want us to kind of see some things here that I think are really important to what we're going to be talking about this morning and trying to answer that question. Okay, I'd love to know who God is. I'd love to, you know, have a relationship with God, but who is he? How is this possible? And as we look at this passage, what is really interesting is this, that Pilate looks, he's the governor. Okay, the Jewish people can do nothing except for what the Roman government tells them to do. A lot of the Jewish community gets a bad rap for, you know, they're the ones that crucified Jesus, okay? There's an element of truth to that, but the bottom line is this, the Jewish people had no authority whatsoever. Because if they did, what are they doing taking them to the Roman government? Guess what? They knew that the only way a crucifixion or anyone found guilty is to be done is through the Roman government. So they come before Pilate and they say this guy's causing riots everywhere, he's causing problems. They even throw in this thing about he's telling people not to pay their taxes for the Roman government. And by the way, he's also saying that he's the king of the Jews. Okay? Now, if you know anything about the story, you know that's a half-truth, okay, which is a full lie, okay? A half-truth is always a full lie. They made up the part about him saying not pay the taxes, because if you know the quote of Jesus, it's a pretty famous quote. A lot of people that even aren't believers have heard this quote, where Jesus looks at the people and says, "Render to Caesar that which is Caesar, and to God which is God's." Okay, so they did not tell the truth on that part. Then they get to the part about the Messiah, and they go, "Hey, now he's saying that he's the Messiah." Now, I don't know if any of you have read the Da Vinci Code or seen the film or anything like that. A lot of buzz and stir about, you know, well, what's accurate, what's not accurate. I believe one of the things that he throws out there is the fact that Jesus never really said that he was the Messiah. His followers came up with that, and therefore it took up on a legend of its own. Now, I want you to understand that this is where they got it wrong, okay? This is one of the spots that they got it wrong. There's a few other spots, but this is one of the spots they got it wrong, because if you knew anything about the culture of that day, when Pilate asked Jesus this question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus replied, "Yes, it is as you say." Now, a lot of people said, "Well, why did he make a comment back like that? That's kind of a weird comment. In that day, in that culture, that was the way of saying, I affirm what you are saying. Jesus was on trial, and just like you do the whole, you know, I swear to tell the truth, okay, all that stuff, this is what Jesus was doing. He wasn't trying to be weird. He wasn't trying to be, you know, hard to understand or anything like that. He just came out and said it. Yes, it is as you said. In other words, I'm affirming that the answer to your question is yes. So right here, it kind of blows it out of the water where it was the whole thing of, well, now really, you know, did he ever really say that he was? And there's other parts even that Jesus does come out and say, yes, that's who I am. But here is Jesus on trial, and he says that, and here is the first time that Pilate, who has the authority, not anybody else, he looks at the people and says, I find him not guilty. Now, if you've done any history study whatsoever, okay, you know, if you could be on the show, you know, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Have you all seen that show? Okay, we got a lot of dumb people in, you know, in America. There's no doubt about that. And there's sometimes I'm like, are you sure that I learned that in fifth grade or second grade? Because I don't know the answer to some of these things. But, you know, one of the things that we all know is, where is our government from? You know, this is where we learned a lot of how to do government. Pilate has just pronounced him not guilty, which means what? He should be able to walk. In the United States of America, if a judge came out and said, I find no fault with this man, we would say, okay, case closed. But what begins to happen is Pilate gets worried. And you know why he's worried? Because he's already had some run-ins with the government himself. And he realizes, I can't lose control or else I'm going to lose my position. So he makes a political move. Later on in the story, what happens is Pilate then looks at the people and says, look, again, I find no fault with this man. He is not guilty. And then there gets to be a bigger and bigger riot. And they start pointing out to him, hey, the worst thing you could do is to let this guy go because there's a lot of rioting because of him. So finally he makes the good old compromise. And he says, I'll tell you what, he's not guilty, but I'll have him flogged. In other words, I'm going to have him whipped like you would not believe, and then I'm going to let him go. And they say that's not enough. We want him to be crucified. And finally Pilate says, all right, okay, you can take him away. I'm not going to have anything to do with it anymore. Four times, Jesus was found not guilty, even by Herod. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Herod so you'll kind of understand where all this is coming from. Herod is the same guy that was wanting to marry someone that John the Baptist, Jesus' cousin, had said to Herod, you can't marry that lady. It would not be legal. You're not supposed to do that. So Herod gets mad, okay, throws John the Baptist in jail. And then what happens later on, through some really stupid decisions by Herod, he ends up having to behead John the Baptist. Now think about this. You're Jesus. You're sitting before Herod. He's just killed your cousin not too long ago. And he's killed John the Baptist, who was the forerunner to Jesus Christ. You wonder why Jesus didn't zap him. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he had him right there in front of him. But I think what is so interesting is if you were here last week, we talked about blind Bartimaeus and how here's this beggar that cries out and Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem. He knows that he's going to be killed. As a matter of fact, he's already told his disciples just a few verses previous to meeting Bartimaeus, hey guys, here's what you need to know. I'm going to be crucified and that's where I'm going. And he stops for this blind beggar that wants to see. Now here's the most strange part to me of Jesus' entire dealing with people. Herod stands as the only human in history in which Jesus never gave a response. You know, that really speaks volumes, doesn't it? 1 week previous, a blind beggar can stop Jesus in his tracks. And Herod, who is powerful in the Roman government, who brings Jesus in, not because he wants to see a miracle so that he'll believe, but he wants to see a miracle so that he will be entertained. And Jesus goes silent. I would give anything to know what Jesus' thoughts were. But here's the amazing thing. If Herod would have looked at Jesus and said, you know, I've really done some bad things, man. I killed your cousin. I killed John the Baptist. I mean, this is kind of a bad thing here. But I really believe that you're who that you say that you are. Things would have been radically different for Herod as it was for Bartimaeus. But instead, Herod just thinks it's a circus. He's so excited to see Jesus because he really wants to see a miracle, not so that he will believe. You know something? Sometimes I think we're a little bit like, there's a little bit of Herod in all of us. You'd like Jesus to do a miracle for you, not so that you really need to believe, but just so it'll be cool. And then we wonder why God's silent. You know, God still stops for people that really need him. But he's not really interested in those people that want to use him. And sometimes I think that's what I do with Jesus. I kind of use him for my own personal gain rather than understanding it's really supposed to be the other way around. I'm supposed to be subservient to Jesus, not the other way. And sometimes I think that's the way we treat him. Well, I prayed to God. He didn't answer my prayers. We're getting a little closer to Herod rather than a little closer to Bartimaeus. See, Bartimaeus recognized, hey, you're the Son of God. You can do anything that you want to do. I really want to see. But Bartimaeus already believed in Jesus as to who he was. He didn't need the miracle to do so. A lot of times in my life, I kind of want that miracle so that I can kind of say, wow, that was cool. Now that I can tell other people what I've experienced. Or that, well, that'll help me to believe a little bit more. And you know something? Jesus is not interested in that. And you wonder why God's silent sometimes, and sometimes because we want to pull him as a little puppet and say, hey, God, give me this, give me that. I want you to skip on down so that you can kind of get to the answers to the questions that we posed at the beginning. Who is God? And one of the other questions that I hear sometimes is, okay, let's take a guy out here that's on a remote desert island, and let's say that he never, ever hears of Jesus. Can he experience God's salvation? It's a good question. And there's thousands of people around this globe right now that have never heard the name Jesus. So what's going to happen? Does that mean that they're condemned because they never heard the name Jesus? They never had the shot? I mean, is this unfair? Is this what a good God would do? Let's look at verses 39 to 43. And this is where we'll spend our time this morning. One of the criminals hanging beside him scoffed, "So you're the Messiah, are you? Prove it by saving yourself and us too while you're at it." But the other criminal protested, "Don't you fear God even when you are dying? We deserve to die for our evil deeds, but this man has done nothing. He hasn't done anything wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus replied, "I assure you, today you will be with me in paradise." You may say, okay, Alex, well, what does that have to do with the two questions? I don't understand where the answers are in that. Well, here's what you need to know. And I'm going to break down a little bit of grammar for you. We're going to go a little bit deeper, okay, and then we'll kind of come out of this. I know you're thinking, grammar, now wait a second. Okay, I didn't come here for a grammar lesson. I was terrible in grammar, I'll just be honest with you. You know when you had to diagram sentences, did that annoy you as much as it did me? I never understood the purpose for that. That just drove me crazy, you know? They were like, where are you putting the participle? And I'm like, here or here? No, maybe here? I just drew a stick man every time and just hung stuff up there because I didn't know where things went, you know? And they were like, you never put the verb here. And I'm like, well, I do. It's kind of my way of diagramming, you know? The verb will always go like this, you know? But let me tell you what's going on here. When the criminal looks at Jesus and he says, remember me when you come into your kingdom, that word there, remember, is in the imperfect. And you say, oh, great, here it goes. You know, this is going to be so deep. No, just hang with me, okay? What it literally means is this. When anything is in the imperfect, it means to repeat the question over and over and over. It wasn't in the perfect, which just means, and we asked, okay, once. It means, and they kept on asking. In other words, as Jesus and these two criminals were on the cross together, the one was railing at Jesus, saying, mocking him, saying, well, if you're really the Messiah, why don't you just get us down, you know, get yourself down. And the other guy says, no, 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 we don't need to go there. And he kept on saying to Jesus over and over and over, just remember me. Just be mindful of me. You notice he doesn't even ask really to get into heaven. He's just like, hey, when you get there, if you happen to think of me, that would be great. You know what the picture here is? Of a guy who is repentant in his attitudes and actions and realizes, I'm not worthy. So if you can just remember me, just kind of, if you just happen to think about me. And he says it over and over. It's a desperate plea, and it's the way that we come to God, not in the way that Herod did, but in the way that this guy did, over and over and over again. Just kind of remember me. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, Jesus, with the heart that only the Messiah, the Son of God, could have on a cross, who at that point in time, if you've seen The Passion, the movie, and you go, kind of go, man, that was gross. That was really bad. Folks, it would have even been worse than what they portrayed. Okay? He was unrecognizable as even being a human being, is what the Bible records. His flesh would have been like him. And out of that desperation of hearing that other man, Jesus looks over at him and says, today, you will be with me in paradise. Now, you want to talk about something shocking? That would have been the worst thing that you could have ever said, because let me tell you what word Jesus uses here. He doesn't even use the word heaven that he's used hundreds of times in his messages. He is shoving it in the face of every theologian who was alive at that time, because what he literally says to him is, you will be with me in the seventh heaven. See, because at that time, what they believed was there were all these different levels of heaven. You know, if you were kind of good, not too bad, and you kind of followed some of the commandments, you got in the first heaven. If you were a little bit better than that, you got in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. Seventh heaven was the ultimate. This was you and God and a few others. Then everybody else was kind of in a crowd, you know. I don't know if you've ever envisioned heaven like that. That, you know, you're just kind of in a crowd and Jesus is way up there. You're way back there. It's not the way that it is. And what Jesus does is he blows the minds of every listener that day. And he goes, you will be with me today in the seventh heaven. Now, you think somebody got angry in the crowd? You better believe it. Because what did this guy do to deserve to get in the seventh heaven? Absolutely nothing. Which should prove to you and I, there is absolutely nothing that you can do to get in. It's by the death on the cross, and by God's grace, that Jesus looks at this guy and says, seventh heaven for you, my friend. Seventh heaven. As a matter of fact, Jesus pulls the word that comes from an ancient Persian word, which literally means to walk in the garden of the palace with the king. You know what Jesus is saying? I'm establishing back the way it was in the garden with Adam and Eve. You will walk with me in the garden. And if you go back to the Orient and you look at the Persian kings, this is the word that Jesus pulls. As a matter of fact, our word paradise, you would recognize it in the Greek. It's paradisio. It's where we get that word from, paradise. The seventh heaven, to walk with God in his garden. Are you talking about powerful? What a powerful statement. This is the God that lives. This is only God that could make statements like this and look at the guy and say, it's not about you, it's about me. Because guess what? Was the guy baptized? For those that think, oh, you got to be baptized in order to be saved. No, He died on the cross. What good deeds did this man do in his lifetime? Well, obviously not very many, because he wound up on a cross being called a criminal. So guess what? It's not about that. It's about Christ on the cross. I was in ROTC my freshman year, and you're going, what? I actually was. It was the last university in the country that required of the freshman males ROTC. And so we went through a year's worth of ROTC training. And you're going, you have got to be kidding me. I am not kidding you. The coolest part of it was they taught you all these survival skills. Now, man, that's what we as guys ate up. We didn't care about, you know, how to find your way with a compass. You know, it was like too hard for us. You know, we were like, well, here's a map, you know, and the officer would get really mad. You know, you had to find your way with a compass and things like that. But then there was all these other things where you had to learn how to, in water, if you ever thrown overboard, you know, which chance for that happened to me is a zillion to one, but you never know. And so how are you going to survive? In the cold, what are you going to do? You know, you're out hunting with some buddies and you fall down in a ravine, you break your leg and it's freezing cold. How are you going to survive? So they taught us all these survival techniques. And so we love that part of it. Then there was my most favorite part, which was the day that Captain Dunkerson came in, who is 6'4" and 240 pounds. And he came in and he said, men, today you become men. And you're like, sweet. What are we doing? You know, which scares you to death anytime an officer says that. And he says, men, today you learn how to shoot an M16. And we're like, you're right, Captain Dunkerson. This is when we become men, to shoot an actual M16, man. This is amazing. So he tells us all about, you know, he holds up the rifle. This isn't it. You know how they always do. It's always this dramatic thing, and you're just like, whatever. This is an M16. It's the most, you know, blah, 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 you know. And we're like, whatever, let's shoot it, you know. And you got to remember, I'm in Arkansas. I mean, guns and Arkansans. I mean, it's like goes hand in hand. I think you're almost born with one. You know, here's your shotgun. You know, one of these days you'll shoot your own rabbit. And so we get out there to shoot our M16s and stuff. And I would go hunting some with my brother. Now, he was always the hunter and fisherman. I always loved to go fishing and things like that. I really wasn't into the hunting part. It always bothered me when we shot the rabbit and we had to put it in our pack and there was the sweet little rabbit and I would stroke it. I mean, I just have a real sensitive heart for that sort of thing. Fishing doesn't bother me. And so we were out there, and so there's 25 of us lined up as guys. We've all got M16s. Now, this is a stupid thing when you really think about it. 18-year-old guys that really don't have any business shooting M16s coming down to the sight range. It's indoors, okay? We got sandbags behind all the targets. And so we've already been taught how you sight in, okay? Which is what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to shoot three times, okay? Wait for everybody to finish. That's an important part. Okay, then you walk down to check out your target, okay, because there was always some idiot that would stand up, you know, everybody else is firing, you know, hello, you know, and Captain would go over there and shove him down to the ground, you know, tackle him and be like, you idiot, you know, and start yelling at him. And so you'd shoot three times, and the goal was to get it within the size of a quarter at about 50 feet, okay, so that you could go down there and sight it in. And so, you know, usually you had three bullets somewhere around here. Some guys were, you know, they had a pattern like this. You're just a terrible shot. There's nothing people can do to help sight you in. You got to have a tight target to see which way it's going. So I went down there on my target, and mine was down and to the right. Okay, there was three bullet holes. You know, they weren't a quarter, all right? They were about like this, down to the right. And so I sighted in just like what he taught us to do, two clicks up and all this other stuff. So we go back, and so he says, all right. He says, fire three more times. So we fire three more times. And so as I get down to shoot, and as I'm laying down there, I knew like the proper breathing techniques and all that other stuff to do what you would consider sniper fire, which is where you breathe all the way in, you exhale just a little bit, you hold it there, and then you shoot, okay? That's what you're supposed to do. Because in your breathing, if you're breathing, then your gun is moving up and down. So I shoot three times, and I'm like, I felt pretty good about that. That was a pretty good shot. You know, I ought to be somewhere near the middle, you know, at least on the target. We go down there, and they're going down one by one, and the captain's just railing at people going, no, you missed the complete target at 50 feet, you know, and just really giving these guys a hard time. Of course, we're 18-year-old guys, totally intimidated by this massive guy. He comes down to mine,
And he goes, well, rather impressive. Of course, you got to remember, there's 25 other of your freshman guys around. You know, you don't want to look bad. He goes, you hit one dead center and then completely missed with the other two. And in my 18-year-old voice and out of stupidity, I said, sir, I think that I hit the other two in the bullseye. And it went completely quiet with those guys. And he goes, son, an M16 is an accurate weapon, but it's not a sniper weapon. It waggles when the bullet moves. It's meant to tear up a man. I mean, he's going through, and I'm like, okay, we don't need the speech here, all right? And so he goes, I tell you what, you think you hit three right in the center in the same hole? Yes, sir. And he pulls out the longest knife I've ever seen in my life. And I thought, he's going to gut me. And he goes, shing. You know that noise they can make, but you never can, you know. And he goes, then there's sandbags behind here. And guess what that means? When I cut into this sandbag, there ought to be three bullets back to back to back. And I'm like, oh, this is not a good day, you know? I'm going to go back, and everybody across campus is going to be like, there's a dude that thought he hit three in the hole. He only hit one in the hole, and two were completely off the target. So which one was right, you know? And so he takes that thing, and he goes right in there. And he goes, shink, and it hits one. And I'm like, there's one. And he goes, and he pulls out that sandbag, and he reaches his hand in, and he goes, I have one bullet, young man. Do you think the other two are in here? Well, I'm already committed. You know what I mean? I mean, I can't back out now. And I went, yes, sir. Please, dear Jesus. You know? And he goes, then I'll find two more. And he takes his knife and goes in, and it goes, dink. And I wanted to go, do you hear what I hear? But I didn't. And he pulls out two other bullets. I'd hit bullseye three straight times. I wanted to, at that point in time, the Cabbage Patch was in. You all remember the Cabbage Patch? I wanted a Cabbage Patch across the room. I didn't. I just acted cool and calm like I'd always done this. It was no big deal. And he goes, in my years of being the captain, blah, 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 we've never had anybody. We need you on our sniper team. I was like, no. That's for the weird people, okay? I'm just here to do target training. I have made myself a legend on the campus. I've accomplished what I have set out to do. Thank you, sir. I am now done, and I never shot again. But I want you to know something. As much as, and I can take you to those guys this day, and they say, yeah, it was uncanny, man. Three right in the same hole. As uncanny as that was, there's probably some people that look at me and go, man, I don't know if that's that believable. But if I brought all 25 guys in here, and I could, if I brought all 25 guys in here, and they were like, yeah, man, I was there. He kept a target for a year and kept pointing it out to us. I finally was like, okay, I probably need to throw this away. It's getting a little egotistical. But you know something? Those 25 people, you'd go, okay, well, I guess he did do that. You know, when it comes to Christ, I know a lot of people are like, well, did he really, and did this really happen? Here's what you need to know. After Jesus was crucified and resurrected, did you know that over 500 people saw him? And not one of those 500 people ever renounced Christ? And they say, well, you know, some people, though, get a little whacked out in their religion. And that's the reason why they believed. Well, here's the problem with that scenario. If you know anything about how 11 of the 12 disciples, because Judas went and hanged himself after he betrayed Jesus, but if you know anything about how the rest of the 11 died, some of them were crucified, one of them was filleted alive, I'm not going to get any grosser than that, okay, that's probably enough information. If you knew that it was a lie, there's not a whole lot of people that would die for a lie. Now, you could believe a lie, okay? Like, you remember David Koresh and all those people down in Waco, Texas? I was about 30 miles from that, by the way, when the flame went up. I didn't have anything to do with it, okay? I didn't know. I was just down there at seminary. That's all that was going on. And you know something? Yeah, as much as those people bought into who he was, there's no doubt. You could start believing some things about an individual, but not as an eyewitness. Because now it's about your credibility. And if you know it's a lie, you're not going to hang around. You know, let's go back in time. Let's just look at the newspapers over the last couple of decades. Watergate, what happened? Somebody's like, hey, man, I'm not going down with this. They rat them out. What happens with all of these things like Enron? People start saying, I'll turn evidence. Sure, right here. Woo-hoo. I helped them shred the documents. I kept a few myself. I can put them behind bars. I'm not dying for the lie. Matter of fact, I'm not even going to jail. Here, I got the stuff. I've told you in the past that the GPS that I would always give you, you know, basically meant good practical stuff. And this is what I wrote down. And this is kind of the GPS for this morning. Many people will die for something that they believe to be true, but people won't die for a lie. They won't. And so as we look at who is God, what's he all about, what about the guy on the island out in the middle of nowhere? Here's what I know, and I think it's answered within these verses because of the heart of who Jesus is. If Jesus is a loving and just God, and he is, then guess what? I trust him completely. Where you get tripped up sometimes is if you think that Jesus is not a loving and just God. But if he's a just God, guess what? He's going to take care of the person that hadn't heard. I totally trust Jesus to take care of the situation. I don't know how it works. I don't know what he's going to say to those people. But I do know this much. I not only serve a loving God, I serve a God who is all justice at the same time. He's not going to let what happened to him happen to somebody else. He's not going to allow for that. How it all works, I don't know. But I do know this. Those that do hear, yes, they have to respond. There is a response. There is a point in which you say, yeah, Jesus is who he said he is or he's not. You know, C.S. Lewis once said about Jesus, either he was liar, he was lunatic, or he was Lord.